And I think that's really how you get wealthy in this business. You don't get wealthy by just buying and flipping everything and selling something just because things are slow for a little while when it's in a great location. Hold on to that thing. Hold on to that deal. Don't get rid of it. You can't take the good with the good times and not push through the bad with the bad times. It's just part of the business.
Welcome to the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Axel Ragnarsson, and on this show, I dissect how seasoned multifamily investors started, built, and scaled their businesses. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with Dave Tupin, who is an Austin-based real estate investor. He's a longtime friend of mine and someone who I've had on the podcast actually a handful of times already. Young guy, just absolutely crushing it within the multifamily space. Has bought over 1,000 units in his career in all kinds of different structures, syndications, joint ventures, bought deals himself, raised a lot of capital. He's operated very large assets and smaller assets, and just has a ton of experience in this space. And he's also the founder of the Real Estate Lab, which is a very interesting software platform designed to help multifamily investors underwrite their deals a little bit more efficiently, a little bit more effectively, and to build organization around their business. And we get into that at the end of the show as well. But this is a great episode for everyone out there who wants to learn more about JVing multifamily deals, specifically small to mid-sized deals, and why the JV structure is actually a little bit more advantageous for these smaller deals than actually going out there and syndicating equity from LPs and collecting, you know, kind of structuring it in a more traditional syndication structure or private equity structure of a pref with a split that's very favorable to LPs. We talk about JVing deals. We talk about why Dave has moved away from syndicating deals and towards primarily joint venturing these smaller deals. We spend a lot of time talking about operations as well, both asset management, construction management. And we talk about how investors can work with partners that are complementary, because this is something that Dave does a lot of and does really well, which is somebody brings him a deal. He has experience operating and experience raising capital, and he has capital himself. And putting those two pieces together is something that he is very good at. So if you're somebody who's listening and maybe you're in a position like David's, or maybe you're in the deal finding position, you should listen to develop a better sense of how you might be able to work with somebody on the other side of the table, because that is truly how you scale and actually grow a portfolio in a shorter period of time. So be sure to give that a listen as well and stick around as we get to that towards the end of the episode. But in general, killer episode. And if you want to listen to the other episodes on the podcast with Dave, go check out the show notes. I'm going to try and have them linked down there. And if you haven't already as well, just a quick plug, check out the 7-day multifamily program. It's been live for a month now. We've had all kinds of interest, just a ton of interest. We've had a lot of individuals jump into the course. I think over, 75, 80 people now. And the feedback has been incredible as it relates to the content that is within that program. So if you're an investor who is looking to start or scale your multifamily business, there's content in there that's going to be directly applicable to your scenario. So go check it out if you haven't already. That link is going to be in the show notes as well. But let's get to this episode with Dave Tupin. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Multifamily Wealth Podcast. Joining me this week is Dave Tupin. Dave, I think you've been on 3 times. And I probably should have checked this before I hit record, but you might be one of the few 3-peat guests. Well, actually, this will be number 4. So I think if we're on number 4 here, you might be in some rare air. But happy to have you back here to talk about what you've been working on and start talking about, small mid-sized multifamily, probably touching on a lot of the stuff we've discussed in previous episodes, which will be linked in the show notes for everybody who's listening. And you should go back and listen to those if you haven't heard the previous conversations with Dave. But Dave, how are we doing, man? Appreciate you coming back on.
I'm doing great. I didn't know this was 4. I thought this was like 2. Yeah, I guess 2. I've definitely done 2. So
I've been doing, well, what's funny is you've done 2, and I think you may have forgotten this one, because I also forget like the first 50 episodes on this, because this was back in 2020, I believe. So we're coming up on 4 years of doing this now, which insane to me. I think you might have been like number 3 or 4. Like, you were real early.
Oh,
I think
wow.
That might have been the first time we ever spoke. I just hit you up on Instagram. I was like, yo, I'm doing a podcast. You want to come on it?
And that's like, right. I'm like, who's this guy that sounds like a car mechanic with the name Axel? And then I just come in here and you're just like the coolest guy. You buy multifamily. I'm like, this is awesome.
Yeah, so probably the last two are a little bit more top of mind than that one. I don't even know if I consider, like, it's funny. I went back and listened to one of like the really early episodes I put out on this, and I was just like, oh man, I had no idea what I was doing. Like, bad gear, poor audio, shitty questions. It was like a trifecta of like, all right, man, like you gotta straighten this out. But
yeah,
but nevertheless, I think this is number four. I'm gonna go back and link the other ones, and if it's not, I'm gonna look like an idiot. Not everybody listening, but we'll find out here. So
good.
I think so. But for those that maybe haven't heard your other episodes, why don't you give everybody kind of a refresh on your story, how you got into real estate, kind of what you're up to nowadays?
Yeah, I'm a multifamily investor for the past 7 years, and more recently a software founder. Started a software company in the past 2 years, but I started back in 2016. Before syndication was kind of like a big thing. And so, you know, I basically just got my first property under contract and then figured out how to raise, you know, it's not a lot of money, but $200,000 for that first 12 unit deal. And just kind of powered through it, learned the hard way on a lot of things, had a couple mentors along the way. I've lived in now three of the properties that I've bought, soon to be four. I'm moving out of one right now and I'm moving into another. And I love multifamily, man. It's all I do. It's a great business to be in. There's a lot of money to be made. And it's just cool. You know, what I really like about it is creating and turning around properties that maybe are like a total dump into something that's just like really a cool community with amenities and this and that. So we do a lot of transformation type projects. But yeah, overall done about 21, 22 projects. That we bought, we're built, and I think it's around like 1,400 apartments total. And then I've got some commercial mixed use storage kind of scattered among those. So yeah, nice. I'm a total junkie.
Yeah, you're a crack addict like the rest of us. I mean, and you know, I know we spend a lot of time kind of tearing into that first deal you did, which is a really interesting one. Well, I think it was technically your second deal, which was like 90 some odd units right up in Michigan.
Third deal.
But the story behind that, in terms of the leap from going to two kind of smaller projects relative to that deal, we get into all of that in some of the other episodes. So I'll, you know, we won't rehash it here. But again, if you're listening, go listen to those other episodes, as well as you and Tori's quest to go and make a bunch of money assigning some, you know, deals that you got from a direct mail piece, buying some other ones. Another killer story that I think we talk about, and that I also talk about with Tori because he's been on a couple times. Look at me just plugging a million other podcast episodes. But again, I mean, really impressive story. And I think that the highlight that I really take from your story, because it is somewhat similar to mine, is, well, slight difference in that I did a lot of projects, just my own resources, and they were all much smaller. But then I kind of, you know, dove really headfirst into the syndication world because I was like, oh, I want to scale and do more deals. And then as I did more deals where we were syndicating them, although we still do some of those, I started to appreciate the smaller deals relative from a unit count standpoint that I was just doing myself. Or with a couple of other partners, like, and I'm realizing that that's kind of the business I want to build, which I know is what your focus has really become over the last 12, 18, 24 months, maybe if we go back a little bit. Let's touch on that, because I want to talk about why you've made that shift. And I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase the question, but you were syndicating a lot of deals, or, you know, a handful of deals with active GP partners, obviously all of the LPs. And then you started doing, you know, maybe 100 plus large deals in size. And then there was a shift in focus to doing smaller, defined, you know, maybe 10 to 50, right? If we're going to start defining that from a size range standpoint, why did you make that shift? Was it financially motivated? Was it lifestyle motivated as it relates to kind of the lifestyle you wanted to build around the business, or some other reason altogether?
Yeah, I think it's kind of twofold. So yeah, I did, I don't know, 600, 700, 800 units on some larger projects with a single co-GP that could also do, you know, guarantor, whole guarantor thing. And yeah, I would raise a majority of the capital and do, you know, a lot of the work, and we'd kind of split activities. But so yeah, we bought a lot of those deals together, and I just didn't love, I wasn't as passionate about it, I guess. And then at the end of the day, I feel like you don't really own the real estate when you've got, you know, 15% of this huge deal. It's like, I don't, you know, you don't really feel like you own the real estate. And I'm a lover, not just of, you know, syndicating and putting deals together. Like, I love real estate. I want to own the dirt. I want to own the property, the land. Like, I just bought a property recently that, you know, is something I'm going to hold for 20 years. and I brought some partners in on it because it is in just an absolute prime location. It's zoned for up to 6 or 7 stories eventually. Like, so we, you know, I love owning the dirt. It's different than just saying, hey, I'm going to buy this property and I'm going to put $5,000 a unit into these, you know, 80 units, and then I'm going to flip it in 3 years. Like, I think I look at things a little different. But then the next part of it is, you know, I got to a point where I had liquidity, net worth, and a skill set to kind of do it on my own. And so, you know, it's not really unit count driven for me as much as it is, I really stick to this like $3 to $10 million deal range, because I find it very easy to find the capital for those deals, whether it's, you know, a joint venture and we need $2 million and I bring in 2 partners and I'll put in, you know, 500 and they each put 750 in or whatever. Or even if it's a $2 or $3 million raise and I do somewhat of a syndication, bring in 10 to 15 partners. It's relatively easy to get the capital. Then I can also guarantee the loans on my own up to, you know, 10, 12 million. So that cuts out the need for having an additional partner and splitting the pie up, you know, even more. So the fact that I can kind of knock down these 3, 6, 7, 8 million dollar deals relatively easily and they're manageable for us is what I really like. So, you know, I do 3 to 5 of those a year. And then we avoid the pitfalls that you get, which I think a lot of people are seeing right now in 2024, is they bought, you know, too many deals, they overpaid. Their business plan was to buy 150, 250, 300 unit deals. And what happens when one of those deals goes wrong, or your interest rate, you know, went up, you know, from 3.5% to 8%, which I had happen on a property of mine. Fortunately, it wasn't 200 units. You know, you'd be drowning, which a lot of people are. So everything I've got is kind of manageable, you know? So that's part of the reason.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense, right? I think as I've personally done different types of deals, whether it's co-GPing a large deal or being the sole GP on a slightly smaller deal where maybe we're raising a few million dollars, or just continuing to do deals myself, I think I have a lot of the same realizations where I think that it's hard to be in the middle. Like, it's hard to be somebody who's syndicating like 50 unit, $5 million deals in terms of like doing a traditional preferred return with a split, like taking the 30% promote on a $5 million deal. Like, you're better off just buying an 8 unit by yourself with no partners and just getting a good deal. Exactly. That actually financially has more of an impact to your net worth. 100%. And I think people don't do the math around that, right? It's like, if you raise $2 million and you make $2 million and you're giving the first $2 million back to your investors and you're splitting the rest and you're making $300,000-$400,000, that's great. But you could just go buy a $1.2 million deal for $900,000 and go direct to seller and all that. And then you arrive at the same destination with far less work.
And ultimately your risk factor is significantly less buying these larger deals. Like again, I had a deal, it's 50, you know, we talked beforehand, you wanted to get into like some lessons learned. I bought a 52 unit. Fortunately, it's just a JV. I have me and, you know, 2 other partners. And our rate went from 3.5% is floating bridge debt. Our rate went from 3.5% to 8%. So our payment went from $30,000 a month to $50,000 a month in the course of like, I don't know, 14 months. Yeah. But, you know, I don't have a bunch of investors on there that, you know, we're break even right now. I don't have a bunch of investors on there that are missing out on returns and payments because, you know, we JV'd that deal, but it's also managed. If I need to kick in, you know, $10,000 every 2 or 3 months to help with some bills, like, I can do that. If that was a 200-300 unit deal, you know, you could be talking, you know, $50,000 a month that property's sucking, you know? So, and that's what we're seeing right now, is why people are giving deals back to the banks, is because they can't manage that. And fortunately, that's my only deal that's kind of in that position, you know? So, you know, I can just imagine if you were like shooting for the sky and bought all these big deals last 2 years, you know, people, right, that are in that position. It's just, it's,
I'm
tough.
An LP in some of them.
Well, it's tough, and nobody expected it. So you can't put all the blame on the sponsor. It's obviously the market shifted dramatically, but we're learning, right? That this is a, you know, I wouldn't say it's a volatile market, real estate, but you, there are unexpected things that will happen that are really tough to plan for.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, as it relates to like picking your focus, like, I think a lot of, there is a lot of reasons to focus on larger deals, call it 100 plus unit deals, $10 million plus, where you're syndicating the deal. Even if your promote is, you know, if you're taking 30% of the upside on a deal like that, you can probably sit down and do the math as it relates to, okay, well, maybe that's similar to what I would earn by buying a good 20 unit deal. Like, you can actually do that math. But in those larger deals, you can take fees, right? And I think that that's a reason a lot of people do that is because they want to go and build a platform, right? They want to go and hire the acquisitions guy. They want to hire the administrative assistant. It's a little bit easier to do that if you're picking up an acquisition fee when you're buying stuff, or if you have some like asset management fees. Is that a desire of yours in terms of like, do you have the goal, like the goal of building a team around the real estate business, or are you content kind of just being a mercenary taking down deals yourself? Like, what's your thought process around that component of the business as it relates to your strategy?
No, we're growing. We're growing our portfolio a lot. We're doing another acquisition right now, a 45 unit deal in San Antonio. It's a joint venture as well. No, I've built a team. Yeah, I've got asset managers. We're doing in-house property management now in Central Texas. And our goal is to only continue to expand that. So, you know, definitely continuing to do that. But the goal is not to just do as big of, like, I buy property again for a specific reason, and it's to make money. You know, I'm not going to do a 200 unit deal just for the sake of doing a 200 unit deal, because I've done 20 unit deals that make more than 200 unit deals sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the focus, like buy good real estate. I will buy 150, 200, 250 unit deal, have the ability to do that if it's the right deal. But I've just found that the best properties at the best prices are normally you're buying them from that mom and pop category. And normally those people don't own the really, really big assets. So I'm just targeting good deals, and no matter what size it happens to come in at, you know, we'll tackle it. It's just, I'd say a majority of them come in under that $10 million mark for us.
Yeah. And that makes sense. I mean, we're just in the same lane here, rowing the same boat. So I get everything you're saying to a T, right? And my whole thought process too is like, it would be nice to earn big fees on bigger deals, because then you can more predictably hire. But like, if you're buying killer real estate deals and you're getting into your promote in a year and you actually have cash flow from the real estate itself, yeah, you can still, you know, maybe it's a little bit more volatile, but you can still make those hires. Correct. I did not know that you brought property management in-house. This is interesting. This is news to me. So when did that happen? Yeah. And are you, did you kill half of your brain cells? More than that? Less than that?
Yeah. No, I've lost them all at this point, actually. No, it's very recent. We've got two properties, a 21 and a 16 unit. And then we've got a 50 unit up North Austin. That's a new build we just finished leasing up. And then we've got a fourth one is a 45 unit that we're buying in San Antonio. So it's not a lot of units.
Gotcha.
But my plan is to build that management in-house here for Austin and just to keep growing with the stuff that we're buying here. So
nice.
Yeah, I'm trying to buy all long-term stuff, you know, kind of at the moment. So, you know, I think it just makes sense for us to have the control and the management for here, at least.
Yeah. So did you just hire like a, you know, like a PM or some similar title to run the whole thing? And what about construction? Are you still going to keep working with GCs on that side, or is there any objective to bring that in?
We've got GCs. I've got the property manager that does the leasing. You know, I've got a full-time maintenance in-house here in Austin. Yeah. Then I do a lot of work on the construction management. I have an asset manager as well. She does a lot, helps a lot with the construction and overseeing the projects as well. So
is she local, remote? Like, she getting on site?
Local.
Nice.
On site. She's in San Antonio. So she's, you know, I do a lot of the CM work still up here, because what I like it too, I think it's like, you know, it's hard to outsource something that's like really within your skill set until you really are at the point of pulling out your hair doing it. And you know, I work all the time. I work every single day. I love doing it. I love getting on site. You know, I love being able to tell my investors like, hey, I'm on site on a lot of our projects. So yeah, I still enjoy doing it, but you know, that's something that will continue to kind of be outsourced over time. Yeah. We've only got 11 assets right now. And I think, although that is a ton of work still between here and Michigan, you know, something like 600 units and 70% of that is third party managed. So, you know, it's all manageable at this point still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 150 units, couple hundred units in terms of like what you're responsible for, the boots on the ground management is, you know, especially if you got an asset manager and a PM, it's local, right? Yeah, it's achievable. Yeah. The tricky part is when that grows and next thing you know, you got like 5 employees, 7, 8, whatever on the management. And that's where, you know,
right.
Speaking from experience, it's a little bit more challenging. But all right, let's talk about JV partnerships, because you do a lot of deals with JV partners. And I think that there's a lot of people listening to this that probably fit one classification, right? Or fall into one classification. They got some money. They're, you know, I've met a lot of LPs through this podcast, and there's a lot of people out there that have some dough. They're investing as an LP. Maybe they want to get into the active side, but like they don't, you know, they don't have the time to go out there and source the deals, run the deals, et cetera. But they kind of want to be a little bit more active than just purely writing LP checks. And then there's a lot of young hustlers who were maybe us 5 years ago, or still, you know, kind of fit the mold of what we're doing, where they're active. Maybe they got a small portfolio. They want to start doing bigger stuff. And we got to put those two together somehow, right? And I think that those are some of the best JV partnerships I've been in, is where you have two people that kind of sit in those roles. I know you've been on both sides of that table, as have I, but let's talk about what you're doing now, or how you're frequently partnering with other active investors right now on a deal-by-deal basis. Roles, responsibilities, kind of how you structure it, and then I'll get into maybe some tactical, like how do you actually divvy up a deal and how do you conceptually think about that?
Yeah, I think there's just so many different scenarios, right? There's a scenario where, you know, maybe there's like a young guy who's like really wants to get into a deal, and they're doing the work cold calling and out there kind of attacking deals, and they end up bringing me a deal that makes sense. We make an offer. What we'll do is we'll just split a portion of, you know, whatever carve out, you know, because when we do our JVs, you know, I'll have still, it's almost like when you have a syndication, we'll have a portion of capital or equity for the capital pool. And then I'll carve out a piece of equity for the sweat equity that I put into the deal as well. So, you know, I'll just give them a piece of that, depending, you know, let's say that's a 30-40% chunk of equity, anywhere from a couple percent up to maybe 10% for bringing that. And if they're going to be north of towards that 10%, it's normally because they're boots on the ground too, or, you know, we're going to be putting them to work. And then if, you know, if it's not as needed, you know, then maybe a fee on the front end and a little slice of the equity in the deal kind of as an incentive to say, hey, like, let's keep doing some more deals. Like, you may not have any experience, but you did bring this deal that was of value. And, you know, we've kind of since taken over the reins from there and are in charge on the deal. But, you know, like, you know, come on in on the deal with us, get a little piece of ownership, learn a lot. And now on the next deal, you've got a lot more ammunition to earn a larger and larger piece of the project. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that's kind of how we do it with that scenario. You know, in the other scenario where I find a deal and we've already got the deal queued up, I think it's just kind of a negotiation. Like, what, first of all, what percentage makes sense if we're going to have, you know, let's say we need $1 million down payment in equity. Just depends on what I have at the time, what I can put towards that. If I can put 100, 200, 300 towards that. Or, you know, or are we going to do a deal at the time where I've a guy that has $1 million, he wants to, you know, buy that whole chunk of equity, you know, they'll put $1 million up and we'll have some sort of, you know, 60-40, 70-30 split, or they'll get, you know, I've done ones where, you know, they'll get a 10 pref, but they'll only get 25% of the equity and I'll have the other 75. So I'll have a much larger equity share there. So I'd say every deal is so different. I don't have a standard format. I don't have it's like the deal comes up. Depending on the situation, we figure out what's equitable for everybody. Normally, I'll come up with that initial structure. And then if there needs to be any negotiation with like a larger investor coming in, then we'll kind of just have a discussion on what makes sense.
I think you did just touch on it. And I think, and it outlines how to conceptually even approach the conversation, right? Which is, you still have the equity that is being used to compensate the investors, right? So let's say, you know, you need $1 million and to fund this project. Who's bringing the $1 million? Right. Maybe you're bringing some, maybe they're bringing a much smaller chunk, and then you have, you know, maybe a couple of other investors that are involved to bring this $1 million. I think where people get tripped up is they're like, well, how do we like assign the equity? It's like, well, no, you know, you can still treat this as like a real estate private equity deal fundamentally, where it's
correct.
You have some kind of a preferred return, you got some kind of a split. You know, you back into the returns that the capital wants to make, and then we're taking that promote or that GP equity or the upside in the deal, and that's what we're divvying up to compensate everybody who's bringing different facets of the deal to the table. You know, you're doing asset management, you're signing on the debt, maybe you're getting 70%, this person found the deal, maybe they get 30 or whatever, right, for that specific deal. And I think separating the conversation as it relates to like, well, I'm going to write this check, what should I get for this? It's like, no, you're just going to be in the same pool as all the other investors. What we're talking about is the upside in the deal. And exactly. That makes that conversation a lot more simplified. And then it becomes a negotiation over that specific pool of equity.
Exactly. So the only question is, are you doing a preferred return or not? If you're doing a preferred return, then you have like your promote or your split over that. And if you're not, then it's pretty much just like, who owns what percentage of the deal? And just like you said, we look at the deal and the returns. And if I could get, you know, I did a deal where I just did a 50-50 split. I didn't put any money in. So this is 3 or 4 years ago. Investors put up all the capital. It's like 750K. Smaller, this is a 20-unit deal. And they had 50% and I had 50%. And that 50% was enough to give them a 2x return in under 2 years. It's like a crazy good deal. So that's why I could, could structure it that way. They still got a great return, but with kind of a lesser equity than I say you normally would have. Now I'm doing a deal right now, which is a great deal, but not quite the, you know, grand slam that the other one was. So we're doing a 70-30 because 70% is equitable enough for them to earn, you know, a really solid return on their money. And, you know, we're still getting, you know, 30% of the ownership for the time that we're putting in, the effort, the risk, the liability, signing on the debt, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we do the same thing in our business. Now, given that you've done a lot of these, what are some lessons learned from a partnership standpoint, whether it's structure, whether it's how to best work with a partner, whether it's, hey, I worked with a bad partner and this is kind of what I learned from that arrangement. Like, do you have some that come to mind?
I haven't had a bad partnership in years. I did when I first started. I had some bad partnerships. And so that drove me to, you know, that drove me to not want, you know, too many partners, which is why I think I do deals that are manageable enough for me to not need partners nowadays, other than capital partners. You know, and then I had a business partner that was who I bought, you know, 600-800 units with, and they were good partners, but we just kind of ended up, you know, went separate directions eventually. You know, my first priority is always like, we're kind of a one-stop shop. You know, I like to do deals where we are the sole manager and decision maker, where I'm the sole manager and decision maker. So, you know, I don't do a lot of co-GPs, and it's not because I won't, or I don't necessarily want to, but because being the sole GP carries its own liabilities, right? Like, I'm doing the deal on my own, which is most of the last 10 deals we've done. You know, I carry not only most of the upside, but I carry most of the downside and responsibility. If something goes wrong, it's all on me. There's nobody else to blame. So you're taking a lot more risk by doing that, which is why I'm very selective on our deals. But I like that because I get to kind of be in control. And I don't want to say I'm a control freak in a bad way, but I'm very particular. And I really like to control the process because I think, you know, we do a good job. We have good systems and you know, we're honest. So we take a lot of the risk factor out by having not non-trustworthy partners, you know? So as an LP, something you have to really think about. As an LP investing in, you know, let's say a 200 unit deal in Dallas or Orlando or wherever it's at, and you've got the sponsor that you're talking to, but they've got five other co-GPs that they're also doing the deal with that are all raising equity. Now, who's the main cook in the kitchen? Who's the one calling the shots? If something goes wrong, who's the one putting money up? I don't do, you know, capital calls. If I can help it in any way, shape, or form, I'm putting my money up before my investors because I don't want to have to go back to them for more money. So in that scenario where you've got six co-GPs, like, everybody's just pointing fingers. Whereas in our scenario, my investors know they're investing with me. And if something goes wrong, it's my responsibility to fix it. So it's just a different, you know, definitely more pressure, different ball game, more pressure. But you know, it's kind of how I like to roll.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like the that management kind of, I guess, that management saying or old adage where it's like, if you want to ensure that something doesn't get done, you go and give it to two people because they don't know who's supposed to be doing it. And it's like, you know, we found that to be so true from a partnership standpoint, because I'm, you know, I partner with loads of investors now as well. And it's a similar finding where it's like the more people you have involved in a deal, the more inefficient the entire operational process becomes, because now you need buy-in on all decisions from a higher number of individuals and you just move much more slowly, which is ultimately a challenge. Yeah. And
correct. It's fast. That's a great point. I didn't think the speed that I could move at is way different.
Yeah. So, which is counterintuitive because you would think, all right, we have more manpower behind the deal. We can actually do, you know, there should be a it's not how it works. It just inevitably never really works that way. Even if you have clearly defined roles and people are on staying in their lane, you have somebody who's in asset management and you have somebody that's in, you know, maybe managing the construction or I should say property management, managing construction. It all inevitably still creates just a higher volume of communication that's required to make decisions, which ultimately makes it harder to make decisions. And then you have all of the financial implications, as you mentioned. I mean, we sold a deal last year that we bought in 2021. We sold it to, it wasn't a big deal. It was like a $4 million deal. And the buyers, there were seven co-GPs in the buying entity. And I was just like, dude, I don't know how anything's going to be getting done behind the scenes there. Like, it's just, And it's just like, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier too, like in the first 10 minutes of this show where it's like, just go, they should all go buy a duplex and they would all go literally make more money than doing that. So, all right, let's talk about you moving around and getting inside of all your projects though here, because I think that's pretty interesting. I mean, you had a nice house. I know. I hung out at your pool. And I know that you sold it, but I just think you might be one of the few people who's like house hacking like larger, mid to large multifamily projects. Is that purely just to get on site and to just do a better job? Is there some other reason there, or what's going on?
Yeah, you know what? I'm single. I'm 28. It's just me and my dog. I think you'd come to my house before. I had the crib. I had pools out in the hills, and I loved it. But it's just kind of lonely. You know, I was on a golf course, and don't you like, you know, it's just people not my age. And I was like, I need to get closer to the city. So I had done a project down closer to the city, and I'm like, all right, let me just move into one of the units. And it works. I don't need anything crazy, to be honest. I live pretty low key. So yeah, it works. And then I'm doing another project closer to downtown Austin, and I'm like, I want to get closer to the city. So I'm actually just going to just skip over to that one and rent from there. You know, it's just another unit that's leased up. And all the projects I do, I don't really do C class. I do like, I'll buy.
You're doing nicer deals. Yeah.
I'm doing like 40, 50. I mean, the one I'm in now is 100,000 unit renovation. So these are like high end waterfall countertops, like, you know, high end finishes, glass showers. Like, we're doing nice stuff. So, you know, they're nice properties. The new one I'm moving to has got a pickleball court I just built, and I'm putting in a sauna and a hot tub, you know, so it's just like cool amenities that tenants like and that I also enjoy.
Yeah, if you're in downtown Austin, it's like, you know, we're not sacrificing quality of life by being close to the project here.
I'm not plumbing it too much.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of want to talk about a dynamic that I think is prevalent in Austin. You can correct me if I'm getting stats and data wrong, but I think this is something that's occurring. I know it's happening in Phoenix because I'm an LP in a deal in Phoenix where this is happening, happening somewhere in Tampa. Long stretch. A decade of rent growth and then hyper rent growth from 2020 to 2022. And I think a lot of supply was added to that marketplace, right? Austin specifically, but then a lot of these southeastern cities, and then rent started to come back the other way, right?
Just a little bit.
What is that dynamic like on the ground as it relates to underwriting deals? Have you noticed this from an operational standpoint? We invest in a very different area where we're extraordinarily supply constrained in the Northeast because the government doesn't let anybody build anything. And also it's not as easy from a land use standpoint to build stuff up here. So we've still had rent growth, which is a different dynamic, right? And I just know people that are investing in the Southeast where they're trying to thread the needle. Like, what are we projecting year one rents? What are we projecting as our vacancy rate? Like, how do you think about that dynamic considering you're investing in the backyard where that's kind of going on?
I think Austin and Dallas are a little different because they just experienced a ton of that hyper growth. And so people built based on statistics and the city approved too many projects. And there's no other way to put it. They built way too many apartments and they're still going to continue to be delivered. And now they are being absorbed. But when you build that many and there's this many being delivered, it's going to take a while to fill them up. So what my thought is that from now in the next 24 months, there's going to be very few new builds. Like people are gonna be like, all right, there's already too many. City's gonna stop saying, you know, we've got too many buildings need to be leased up. We're not gonna approve too many new projects. So I think we're gonna have probably 2 years of not many new starts happening. But we've obviously got all the apartments that started 2 years ago that are being delivered now. Last year that got delivered that are getting delivered next year. So I think there's gonna be a 2, maybe a 3 year kind of very slow period with not much rent growth. You know, leasing, everybody went from multiple tours in a day fighting for a lease to now everybody's given like a month free. Some places downtown leasing up like high rises, 2 months free.
Yeah.
Right. So on the ground, it's slow. rents have come down definitely from where they were peaked, at least last year. And I think if you're in the lease up phase, which I have a project in the lease up phase here, and it's slow, but we just leased one up. It took us on our 50 unit, we just hit 92%. That took us 10 months, whereas originally we were thinking like 6 or 7 months. So we hit, I'd say, pretty close to where we wanted to be rent wise, maybe $100 below. I think our average was like $1,550. We were probably like $1,475 on average. So yeah, it's just, you know, it's just that time in the market. You have the supply, the demand, and then it comes back the other way. And it's just going to keep ebbing and flowing. Now in Michigan, on the other side of the coin, they built a good amount, but they did not build like they did here or Miami or Arizona or wherever. So we're actually really steady up there. We're not seeing like crazy growth, but very steady and stable, which I would think with times like now, things would be going the opposite direction, but actually doing really well. So
it's interesting to compare those two markets, right? Well, I mean, you can compare a lot of Northwestern or West, like West Coast, East Coast markets when you get north of like Virginia. But like New Hampshire, for example, in 2023, where rents were going the other way, and a lot of the cities we just talked about, New Hampshire, I'm plugging New Hampshire here, but like 11% rent growth in 2023, which is wild considering that most of the rest of the country was going the other direction, or at least a lot of the major southeastern, southwestern cities. But from an underwriting standpoint, you know, if we're going to get tactical for just a quick second, you're in your spreadsheet, like what are you using to project? Like if you're looking at a deal, somebody sends you a 50 unit deal in Austin, like how do you actually try to account for what's going on there? You making major changes to the underwriting process?
Yeah, I'm still underwriting rent bumps, you know, upon renovation completion. I'm still assuming rent bumps, no, conservatively, or assuming rent bumps after we like fix up a unit. Now in my underwriting, actually year one to year two growth in those renovated rents were starting normally with 0% rent growth. And then year two, maybe like 1% rent growth. And you know, I think we're being probably a little conservative in the fact that that's kind of going to scale back up to like a 2-3% rent growth over the next couple of years. So, you know, yeah, I still feel confident we'll get in, renovate buildings, we'll bump the rents. We're doing it actively right now. We're leasing units. As long as you provide a nice product, you know, we're given in Austin, though, we're given 4 weeks free. But yeah, you know, vacancy factor, maybe a 2% higher than we normally would, maybe 7% instead of 5-8%. But in general, I'm not, you know, nothing that.
Yeah, no drastic changes in terms of. We're just maybe taper off the growth a little bit first year or two. And yeah, which makes sense, right? Because as you mentioned, right, the idea is that it starts to come back, right? Because there's not nearly as many starts right now because of construction and rate, you know, construction cost rates, et cetera. So, I mean, that makes sense. So a quick little asset management question here for everyone listening that might be unfamiliar with why people offer concessions or free weeks or a month, you know, a free month instead of just lowering the rent price. What's the thought process there, right? That's a pretty common practice with the big guys. I think a lot of the mom and pops that have a duplex, they'll just lower the rent a little bit. But, you know, what's the objective in doing that instead of lowering the rent?
Yeah, I want my rent roll to look really strong. And then when it comes to next year, I mean, so if I give a free month and I'm leasing up a 16 unit, and if I give a free month to everybody, I'll lose the same amount. I'm going to lose it up front as opposed to over the course of a year if I had just lowered the rent. But in 6 months from now, you know, if I go to refinance the property, for example, my rent roll is going to be a lot higher. And that's what the bank really looks at. They're not going to care that 7 months ago I gave everybody a free month rent when I leased it up. They're going to really focus on the fact that my income right now every month is higher and my rent roll is higher. And then when I come to renew next year, I can either keep the rent the same or bump it a little bit at the higher rent. Whereas if I had lowered it originally, it'd be harder to kind of bump to that new standard. So I think it's always better to do that. But, you know, people have different opinions. You probably could lease maybe a little quicker if you dropped the rate and didn't do concessions. I think that's probably the only deciding factor is like, would you lease it quicker and eliminate vacancy by dropping the rent as opposed to keeping the rent high and doing the concession? You know, you might net over the course of a year take a little longer to lease and you might actually lose more to vacancy. But for our purposes, these are properties we're looking to refinance next 12 months. So we definitely want the higher rent roll.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, it depends on where you're at in your business plan, right? If you're like, we're in the initial lease up after construction and we're trying to work towards that big refi, like, you know, that dictates how you make that decision in one direction versus if you've had it for 10 years and you're like, I don't know, $1,900 versus $1,875, $1,850, whatever. I don't plan to refinance this for a while. It's less of a, you know, it doesn't move the needle as much. But it's funny because I think that that's one of the biggest, you know, when you try to boil down, like, what do the sophisticated or professional like operators do from an asset management standpoint differently than maybe the small local kind of more mom and pop folks? That's, I mean, there's a number of them, but that's like one of the big ones I've noticed is, like, you know, let's go the concession route versus dropping the rent because, you know, you're preserving building value either when you go to sell or refi. So what's new? What's the objective here over the next 12 months, right? Is it you're doing deals in San Antonio? I know you got stuff going on in Michigan. You're obviously doing deals in Austin. Is it to continue just doing deals in those handful of markets, continue building out the portfolio locally a little bit more so than up in Michigan or some other kind of objective altogether?
Yeah, no, my main goal is to continue buying, I'd say, here in Central Texas. I think, you know, a lot of people are going to start shying away from Austin in the short term because of, you know, supply and just a little bit of a slowdown. But I, you know, I'm very bullish on the city long term. It's a great city to live in. I think it'll continue to be a top city to live in for decades. And so, you know, just because your stock goes down for 1 or 2 years doesn't mean you sell it, you know, if you're a long-term holder. And actually, you should be buying more. So that's what I'm doing. I'm going to try to buy more and get some good deals at discounts while everybody, you know, while there's less demand. And you know, hopefully we do see a little bit of an uptick in supply in properties for sale. And I'm going to buy them all, you know, and then in 20 years, I'll be really glad that I did and that I helped. But I'm a long-term thinker in terms of investing, you know. Been so lucky the last couple of years. We've made so many millions of dollars flipping multifamily real estate. I feel like I got in at a really good time in 2016. And yeah, so when things go a little bit downhill or bad, like, you kind of got to roll with the punches and push through just like you would in any other industry. I think you actually have to lean in and go a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing. We're leaning into it. And I think, you know, everything I'm doing, I'm really thinking 20 years. I'm buying properties that I want to hold long term and properties in good areas that I think are going to just continue to grow. And I think that's really how you get wealthy in this business. You don't get wealthy by just buying and flipping everything and, you know, selling something just because things are slow for a little while when it's in a great location. Like, hold on to that thing. Hold on to that deal. Like, don't get rid of it. It might suck for a while. You might have to put some of your own money. You know, I've probably put a couple $100,000 the last few months into properties just to finish up renovations or, you know, get over the hump or get a refi done or whatever. But long term, these are great properties in great areas and that we're going to do really well on. And it's, you know, you can't take the good with the good times and not, you know, push through the bad with the bad times. It's part of the business.
Yeah. I mean, it's got to be hard every once in a while or then everybody would do it and then there would be no money to make, right? So right. It's like, you know, there's got to be challenges along the way for sure.
And it's a challenging time. There's no way around it. And there's anyone that's been doing this for years and has been active in buying, there's no way they could say they're not being affected right now. Everybody's being affected in some way, some a lot worse than others, but everybody is being affected right now. Deals, you said you're LPing deals that have slowed down, like, you know, I've got some deals that I own with another partner of mine that, you know, I've got some vacancy in a commercial building. I've got that 52 unit of payment or interest rate went from 3.5% to 8%. I mean, it's like, it affects all of us. Properties that we would have sold and probably made a couple $1 million this year that we now can't, right? We're going to have to wait. Like, the change in the market interrupted everybody's plans. But that's a part of what we do. You know,
it is. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's funny because it's like, even if you're somebody who, you know, you're not operating at some level of scale where you're buying a number of deals a year and you're constantly plugged into like the market and then the news and what's going on and the changes and all of that. And, you know, even if you bought a couple properties a year over the last handful of years and you got fixed rate debt and you're in a good spot, you may not even be feeling the effects of this because your tenants are still paying the rent and you're paying your mortgage and you're like, whatever. But as you mentioned, right, if you go to sell, it's a different ballgame. Your buyers can't pay as much as they would have been able to 18 months ago. And it just, you know, it slows down the velocity, makes it harder to sell because people aren't got the numbers they want. And people can't, you know, they can't pay as much on the buy side because of where rates are. And it's interesting in that it creates a situation I found, at least this is how I think about it, where The fewer number of transactions in a given marketplace that have occurred, the easier it is to find a deal that's mispriced, right? Because it's like the less comps you have or that a broker has, for example, to go and take a deal out because there's less closings, there's less volume, the more likely it is that maybe they don't actually understand what's going on in the marketplace at a level that they need to price it effectively. And it's, you know, we're all in real estate because it's an inefficient marketplace, right? And it's lack of information leads to opportunity oftentimes. So, you know, if you start thinking about it through that lens, there's oftentimes, you know, you can find some opportunity when you're looking for it, right? Instead of just kind of shutting your brain off. So yeah, we're hoping to buy a bunch of real estate this year. So we're in the same boat, but yeah, a bit of a reframe for everybody out there.
Definitely. Yeah. If we do three deals this year, I'll be happy. That's my goal, is at least I want to buy at least three properties. So
love it. All right. We're coming up on our time, but I want to make sure we talk about Real Estate Lab, talk about the software. You know, obviously this is a real estate podcast, or else I'd grill you on starting a software company and the trials and tribulations that come with doing that. But talk about Real Estate Lab, talk about how it can help the folks who are listening and I guess just at a high level, discuss what you've built there.
Yeah. I would say it's probably one of the first things people need to invest in that are actively buying multifamily or new to buying multifamily. You know, systems in this business are everything. And that's one of the first things we're tackling, is systematizing your acquisitions and your underwriting. We've got a lot of different tools. You can store all your documents for every property in there. You can kind of track your pipeline and your workflow for all your properties you're looking at. You know, your whole team can work out of there. And each have their own login. We've got a bunch of different underwriting models built into the platform. And then you can like upload financial statements. Our software reads the financial statements and then plugs that data right into the model for you. So we just do a bunch of different things where, you know, we're saving you time. Rent comps. We've got, actually that's coming out next week. So by the time this is released, that feature will be out, where you can pull now all your multifamily rent comps right from in our software. So, you know, it's just a little overview of what it does, acquisitions, asset management. But, you know, why we built it, I really kind of built it initially for myself. You know, I wanted to build a tool, you know, that we could use, you know, but then also I saw a need from a lot of people, because I was, at the time, I was just selling, I had a spreadsheet that was just an underwriting model. And I think like in 2017 or 2018, I sold like $100,000 worth of this spreadsheet. And at $250 a pop, I'm like, man, people really do need, like, which is, you know, it's crazy. Nice. It's like a spreadsheet. Yeah. I was making like $6,000-$7,000 a month selling this spreadsheet, and I wasn't doing any. I just put it on my website, completely word of mouth. And I was like, oh my God, people really need a good model. But there's so much more that software can do. So we started building the software. I started using it. Our team started using it. And then we just basically just refine it and add new features over time. And I am not a tech guy. I have no clue how to code. I still don't know anything about coding, by the way. And I've spent probably $1.5 million building the software out. You know, but we've got some great developers, you know, built a good team, and we now service over 150 companies. And our goal by the end of this year is to have, you know, 400 or 500 companies on our platform utilizing it, and just keep growing and taking feedback and adding new features that our users need. You know, we've got something coming up in a couple months where you can upload your insurance policy. Our software will read your insurance policy, pull out your effective dates, your expiration date, your current premium, your contact, and then right on the page for your property, we'll store that information, and you're going to get a reminder 90, 60 days out from when your policy expires. Stuff like that. So we're organizing pretty much that side of your business. And as you probably know, you know, without something like that, you've got all these systems from, you know, miscellaneous spreadsheets to, you know, your Google folders or Dropbox or this and that. And there's really nothing that organizes all of that acquisition side of things into one spot. So that's what we're trying to do. And it's just a constant evolution. But users are liking it so far, and we're just along for the ride to keep making it better.
Love it, man. It's just interesting because one, you're solving a need, as for all the reasons you just mentioned, right? There's a need here. And I know we were talking about it the other day, like even just specifically the rent comps feature, like that is enough to drive the value in a lot of ways, because that's one of the hardest things for people to solve, is like, how do we systematize this part of the process? Because there isn't a great platform for that. People think Rentometer is great. And, you know, hopefully Rentometer is not listening.
I don't think
but
it
it's
is.
Not that great. Yeah.
I think it's great for single family. It's not really, it wasn't really built for multifamily. That's the thing.
New nuance. Yeah. I mean, it's the amount of times I've had like a broker or somebody, you know, they pull their rent comps from Rentometer and we're comparing my 1905 build or that's the subject property to a 1970s build because they're geographically close to each other and we're not capturing any of the nuance or behind the scenes as it relates to what's going on. But no, it's great platform. Love to see that you're up to, I mean, not a number of users, right? I mean, it's starting to actually become a real platform, I would imagine, for people to start building their business on, which has got to be a pretty cool experience for you behind the scenes, being the guy that's behind it all.
It's wild. I mean, I've spent so much money building it and I've just put so many hours and our team has spent so much time and, I love seeing the evolution. I never thought if you had told me 10 years ago, you'd have started a software company and actually it's made more than a dollar, I'd be like, what's going on here? But yeah, we're honestly doing really well and we're seeing a lot of steady growth. I think we onboarded 20 new companies last month.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah. And it's anybody from people we do have, a lot of people that come in, they're just getting started from, we have a lot of people that own single family rentals that are now getting into multifamily. And then we've got, we've got over 10 companies at this point that have like 200 million plus in assets that buy like, a lot of big deals every year, buy and sell big syndication shops. So we're getting more and more towards institutional crowd on the platform. And that's kind of our goals by the end of this year to be really institutional ready and start bringing on, like I want to get Grant Cardone used to this platform. Like his team needs to be using this. If they're not, obviously they're behind because they're looking at a lot of deals. And if they're not able to sift through those deals, they're going to be unorganized and falling behind. So that's our goal. Work towards that kind of stuff and just keep making it better. So that really it works for everybody. And like you said, the rent comps alone, I agree with you. I think that's going to be enough to draw a lot of people over to the platform. So
for sure. No, I love it, man. Well, people learn more about? Yeah. Well, where can people learn more about, I guess, you in general, maybe reach out to you, follow you, all that fun stuff. And then Real Estate Lab, right? Plug that as well.
Yeah. Best way I would say is always Instagram at Real Estate Jedi. We're going to look up David Tupin. And then, if you're interested in Real Estate Lab, you go on our website, realestatelab.com, and you can sign up for a demo. We got a free trial on there. You can try it out. Yeah.
Love it, man. Perfect. All that in the show notes, along with maybe the 40 other podcasts I mentioned throughout this recording. But go check it out. Great platform. I mean, it's just a great resource, especially if you're somebody who's looking at a volume of deals, right? And you need to stay organized, which I know is a lot of the people who listen to this podcast. But thanks again for the time, man. This has been great. Always fun catching up.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, brother.